is told by you feels accurate to the target, then a truth is assigned to it. A narrative that feels correct in time will convey a strong sense of truth and accuracy. In stark contrast, facts and figures have no built-in internal mechanism for feeling truthful. If we present just facts and figures, then we trigger a paradigmatic mode that encourages the target to use logical rigor over imagination, intellect over feeling, and theories over stories. Clearly, you don't want your target in this paradigmatic thinking. Short and strong narratives that introduce characters who are overcoming real-world obstacles can ignite hot cognitions, which in turn push the target out of paradigmatic mode and out of analytical thinking mode. Here's the basic formula for developing this kind of intrigue frame. Here's the narrative pattern for building an intrigue frame. Intrigue frames, like all narratives, whether fiction or nonfiction, need structure. Without structure, a story wanders around without purpose and becomes boring. Here's a pattern that will give any of your stories a dramatic arc that ends with intrigue. 1. Put a man in the jungle. 2. Have beasts attack him. 3. Open the question, will he get to safety? Clearly, being stuck in a jungle is a metaphor for being in a difficult situation. The attacking beasts are the conflict and the tension. These are the problems faced by the man and the motivation for him to start moving towards safety. Once he is out of the jungle, the tension is resolved and the narrative arc is complete. So, in your story, hold the man just short of safety as long as you want to use the intrigue frame. This is going to give you a narrative arc that takes the target quickly on a strong emotional ride that has conflict and tension, and doing it in this way will fire the hot cognition. Things don't always need to be told in terms of extreme events, but they always should be extreme in terms of the character's emotional experience. That is what makes a good narrative. Why use this pattern? The man in the jungle formula forces you to deliver a narrative in a human, active way where you do something in the real world that shows drive and tenacity, self-confidence, and a connection to reality. When we listen to your narrative, it's not what happens to you that makes you interesting, but it's what you do about the situations you're in. The emotional power in a narrative comes from a character that engages difficult obstacles and finds ways to overcome them. Here's another example of the pattern where I built an intrigue frame with a compelling narrative. I was taught this pattern by a Hollywood screenwriter. It's called the ticking time bomb. Put a man in the jungle. Here's how we do it. Well, I had an $18 million deal some time ago in which I was responsible for finding $6.4 million of the money from investors. The bank would provide the rest of the money for the deal. It took about 10 days, and I had commitments on all of the $6.4 million. Then, less than 72 hours before closing, something unwanted happened. So again, we put a man in the jungle. And now the beasts attack. One of the investors, his name was Jeff Jacobs, went AWOL. His bank would not wire the money without his signature, and I could not close the deal. That was a Friday afternoon. The entire $18 million deal was in jeopardy. I was imagining the worst. Maybe he was at the bottom of his Malibu swimming pool clutching to a bag of bricks and a goodbye cruel world note. I spent all weekend looking for him, but he could not be found. By Monday morning, I was less than 8 hours away from having to either come up with Jeff Jacobs or come up with his money. All of my phones were ringing. On the other end of the line, the investors, the bank, the seller, and my partners, each caller was madder than the last. Now let's ask the question, will he get out of the jungle? I sat down at the computer and started emailing consultants and sales types in our industry. I offered $1,000 for any kind of information on Jeff Jacobs. One of them found me a second address and a phone number, which I called. A woman answered. Luckily, it was Mrs. Jacobs. "You're his wife?" I asked. "Yes, sir, I am," she said. I was thrilled. "Mrs. Jacobs, I am so glad I found you," I told her. "Can you please sign these closing documents on behalf of your husband? They allow for the wife to sign. It's no problem. I would appreciate it so much. I'll even drive out there to Palm Springs to meet you." "Oh, you said this is to help Jeff out," she asked me so nicely. "Yes," I said. "Well, you know, I would love to do that for you." And I cut her short. "Great." Then she cut me off. "But I've been separated from that snake-eyed son of a bitch for 11 years, she told me, and I'll burn in hell before I sign anything to help him out. The minute I heard that, I dropped everything and jumped in the jet headed for Palm Springs. So that's the important fourth step in the narrative pattern, building up the intrigue frame. Get the man to the edge of the jungle, but don't get him out of it. In other words, the intrigue is created by the fact that there's no final resolution. To hold intrigue and to make it work as an emotional event, a hot cognition, I don't complete the story, although it really has a great ending, and I'll come up with that later and tell you about it. And instead, you move to the next frame in the stack, the prize frame. So hot cognition number two is the prize frame. As I mentioned in chapter two, the prize frame, or prizing, lets you position yourself as the most important party in the deal, not the people on the other side of the table. Successful prizing flips the frame. Even though you are pitching the deal, it results in the target chasing you, trying to win your attention. A simple example of the prize frame came from my trip to the Helen Woodward Animal Shelter in Rancho Santa Fe, California. One of the first times I recognized my own power disrupted, status seized, and I watched the frame flip on me. On entering the animal shelter, I had the classic hero frame, right? Announcing, "I'm here to rescue a homeless, abandoned dog." And it was true. The dog that impressed me the most would win the prize, moving in with me and getting free food and medical care for the rest of his life. Soon, I found the dog that I liked, and I was ready to pay the fee, complete the rescue, and Spot seemed like a good enough name, right? And we were ready to go. But wait. "Excuse me, sir." It was the adoption counselor. She was in her early 20s, and if she was your sister, you'd tell her to lose the hair gel and lose the purple eye glitter and the nose ring. "What kind of home do you run?" she asked me. "Do you have young children? What kind of job do you have? If your backyard isn't big enough, we don't recommend a pet like this. And who will take care of the animal when you're at work? And what's the number of that person? And by the way, what's your income level?" Well, this was pretty wild. A 23-year-old volunteer with pink streaks in her hair was telling me that I might not be suitable as a rescuer for this homeless mutt. My hero frame was smashed. Now I was busy defending myself, giving examples of why I was really a good person, good enough to take home a dog. I answered her questions, and once she gave me the nod, I was ready to pay the fee and complete the animal rescue. Wait. Next, I had to fill out an application. Then I was told to come back a few hours later to see whether I was approved. I came in the hero, and the shelter turned me into a supplicant. Now I was begging to be considered a good enough citizen to rescue a homeless, abandoned animal of unknown potty skills. I became the commodity, and Spot became the prize. The shelter had flipped the frame. Let's continue with an example of using the prize frame in a pitch. Because it's specific to my business, pitching deals, I'll start with a detailed example and follow up with a more generic pattern that you can use to develop your own prize frame if you're not in the finance industry. What follows can be used towards the end of any pitch session. Guys, I'm glad I was able to find some free time to come here and show you my deal. I don't always get to meet the buyers, and I know we're having some fun here and talking about this stuff, but I have to wrap up now. I have another meeting. We're super busy, and there just aren't a lot of deals like ours, and obviously none that include me with it. And I'm fortunate enough to be in high demand. So getting serious for a moment, I do have to choose which investors to let in and which to turn away. Before things go any further here, I need to figure out who you people really are. Yeah, we have your bios and we know your reputation, but we have to be cautious about who we bring on board. And I have to sell you to my partner, Joshua, right? Who's going to want to know why I think you would be good partners for us. Can you give me that? Can you tell me why we would enjoy working with you? So what have I done in such a statement? I've delivered the prize frame, and the basic elements include this. Number one, I have one of the better deals in the market. I tell them that up front. Number two, I'm choosy about who I work with. I establish that. Number three, it seems like I could work with you, but really, I need to know more. Number four, please start giving me some material and credentials on yourself. Number five, I still need to figure out if we would work well together and be good partners before I really let you buy into this deal. Number six, what did your last business partners say about you? Number seven, when things go sideways in a deal, when it gets bumpy, how do you behave? How do you handle it? Can you tell me why you guys would be good partners when situations get tough? And number eight, my existing partners are super choosy about who I bring into the deal. Not only do you have to convince me that you're good guys and good to work with and we should let you in, but you have to empower me to go convince my partners to let you in. This kind of prize frame is a hot cognition that signals the target's croc brain that you are strong, that you are not needy, and you are not going to supplicate for a deal. Dr. Robert Zajonc, writing in The American Psychologist, describes the importance of these hot cognitions and the importance of these emotional processes. He suggests, for example, that it's not really important for you to know if someone has just said you are a friend or you are a fiend. What you really need to know is whether the statement was made with affection or contempt, whether the word friend or fiend is the cold part of the message, right? It doesn't matter. Affection or contempt is the hot part. Researchers found that 22 times as much information is given in the hot part of a message. Unlike some of the other frames, the prize frame relies a great deal on how strong your conviction is. In the pattern that I talked about earlier, I've given you the external formula for the prize frame, which is what you say to the target. However, the prize frame doesn't come only from the words that you say. It's how you're organized internally. Here's the internal pattern, the words you say to yourself to fully activate and deploy the prize frame. Number one, I am the prize. Number two, you, buyer, are trying to impress me. Number three, you, buyer, are trying to win my approval. Over time, as you get good at this stuff, you'll begin to see that the prize frame does not rely on words and explanations. It's more about the strength of your convictions about who or what is the prize. Let's move into hot cognition number three, and that's the time frame. When I was selling a deal called Geomark to Boeing, I used this version of the time frame. Guys, my company, Geomark, is a great deal, and you can't bluff me about what you're thinking. I know you agree. Consider the situation we're in. We're here for a third meeting at your Boeing corporate headquarters. Right now, I'm looking at your team. Four Boeing executives, three engineers, two of your top consultants. Why are you here in force? Because you love the deal, and you should love it. The deal is hot, and that's no secret. I've never used this fact to pressure you, but we can't ignore it either. For this reason, we have all got to make a decision about the deal in the next week. Why 1 week? The time constraint is not under my control. It's the market working. It's harsh but true. We have to decide by July 18th if you're in or if you're out. The effect of time on decision-making has been researched for 100 years, and nothing has changed about human nature in that amount of time. In nearly all instances, the addition of time pressure to a decision-making event reduces decision quality. It is true, for instance, that you can get someone to buy a car more easily if you tell him that the sale ends at the end of the day. Why does this strategy work so well? There's a scarcity bias in the brain, and a potential loss of a deal triggers fear. But just because imposing scarcity works well isn't a recommendation to use it. We don't want to taint our deal with the whiff of cheap 1980s sales tactics. We want the target to see us as a professional agent, to trust us. So I tend not to use too much time pressure at all. Extreme time pressure feels forced and cut rate. But the truth is that time is a factor in every deal. You have to find the right balance between fairness and pressure and set a real time constraint. Here's a time frame pattern you can use and follow. Guys, nobody likes time pressure. I don't like it, and you don't like it. No one does. But good deals with strong fundamentals are like an Amtrak train, right? Or more like a deal train. They stop at the station, they pick up investors, and they have a set departure time. And when it's time, the train has to leave the station. You have plenty of time to decide if you like me and if you want to do this deal. If you don't love it, there's no way you should do it. We all know that. But this deal is bigger than me or you or any one person. The deal is going ahead. There's a critical path, a real timeline that everyone has to work with. So really, we need to decide by the 15th. That's it. You don't have to do any more. With just that simple pattern, the time constraint is set. You don't have to be overt or aggressive with time pressure. Every single person knows what you're talking about when you say the train is leaving the station at such and such date and time. Next, let's talk about hot cognition number four, the moral authority frame. Robert Zajonc, the thought leader on hot cognitions, once wrote, "We evaluate each other constantly, we evaluate each other's behaviors, and we evaluate the motives and consequences of that behavior." And this, of course, is the key to the reason we stack frames. Because we're going to be evaluated no matter what happens and what we do. Let's get the evaluation we want, something that's called wanting. So while it's tempting to get caught up in the best way to explain the financial mumbo jumbo and how to best demo our products, the heart of the matter is that you have to do what it takes to create this wanting. There may be other factors that contribute to the effectiveness in the pitch, but certainly one of the most important is getting wanting to happen. How is it done? To create a desire in the target's mind and to go from the pitch to the hook point, every presenter has to use hot cognitions to create wanting and desire. Until a wanting evaluation is in the target's croc brain, the information you are giving is largely being ignored, or at least not making a big impression. Now that we've gone through prize frames, intrigue frames, and time frames and their uses, here's another example that will deepen your understanding of how to use frames to create hot cognitions and, more importantly, wanting. The morality frame in practice. Here we are. The most powerful politicians in the world have people underneath them who will do exactly what they're told. Each has a phalanx of subordinates who will do his or her bidding. Take the President of the United States. If he orders a precision airstrike on a clandestine enemy stronghold, a succession of people underneath him will execute that order, all the way down to the pilot in the F-22. The President can lead us into a war or, with a few pen strokes, sign a bill that will affect millions. His frame, in most of his encounters, is stronger than that of nearly any opposition. The President, like many other world leaders, isn't used to being told what to do. Think about what one has to go through just to become president, how many personal attacks you suffer, and the constant political reframing of things you have said. Once president, though, you may have one of the most sophisticated and strongest frames in modern history. Yet there's one person whose direction the president will follow almost blindly. When David Shiner says to Barack Obama, "Turn around, take your clothes off," Obama does it without question. In every social situation, there are basic human hardwired functions. Let's call them ritual elements of social interaction. Every person navigates the world through social encounters. In each further contact with other people, as we've been discussing, each person brings a frame, which is a viewpoint or a perspective. It doesn't matter if the person intends to bring a frame, he will always find that he has done so. All social encounters are framed. In light of this, when we think about it, not only do physicians like David Shiner tell us what to do, their frame is so powerful that we're nearly helpless in its presence. In fact, the doctor frame may be the most powerful frame in the world. Really? The most powerful frame in the world? Let's explore. If we want to stay alive, we all follow our doctor's orders, and we all have deep respect for the medical profession. Physicians, cardiologists, radiologists, internists, and surgeons, these are people who can save our life or the life of a loved one. So we have an embedded script in our mind that we follow when we deal with medical professionals. When the surgeon stands, we sit. If the surgeon waves his hand towards a table, we go sit on it, uncomfortably, trying to cover up our private areas. Literally, when the surgeon does anything, we're programmed to react. We react to the surgeon automatically. He doesn't react to us, we obey him. The surgeon only nods appreciatively when we say something, but he doesn't even react. The consulting surgeon wears whatever he wants, sometimes a nice suit, other times comfortable-looking casual clothes, whereas at the same time, we're dressed in a generic green gown. Our private parts are showing, we have no underwear on, and it signifies our low situational status. If we were seen anywhere in public in this ridiculous green gown, it would cause us emotional scarring. The surgeon, he's wealthy, and he has all the accoutrement of status, a prestigious degree, a respected position, and an expertise that took nearly 20 years to acquire. And he literally has the power to determine life or death. We're hardwired to follow this script. Actually, most of us, but not all of us. Certainly not Mother Teresa. In December 1991, Mother Teresa entered Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation in La Jolla, California, where she was treated for a bacterial infection and heart problems. With such a notable world figure under their care, doctors and surgeons rushed in to meet her, and frames collided. The doctor's frame has three rules. Rule number one, you do what I say. Rule number two, you defer to my expertise. And rule three, accept my conclusions about life and death. However, when encountering Mother Teresa, the doctors found a person who did not follow the script or fall into that frame. Here was Mother Teresa's frame. Number one, material wealth is worth nothing. Number two, life and death, it isn't critical. Number three, above all else, help the downtrodden. And number four, a rich man is less likely to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel is to pass through the eye of the needle. You see, her frame is not powered by wealth or expertise, instead by a high moral authority. Help the downtrodden, life and death is not critical. As doctor after doctor met Mother Teresa, their strong frames collapsed like a series of dominoes. She did not react to their status or their control over life and death. After all, even death was not one of her primary concerns, and she had often ignored doctors' orders in the past. And as they fell into her frame, something remarkable happened. These doctors could not impress her. Their power frame was disrupted. This is why she so easily convinced American doctors to do something that they hadn't previously considered. Before coming to La Jolla, an affluent seaside community in North San Diego, Mother Teresa had visited Tijuana, a city across the U.S.-Mexican border, where poverty is severe. It was there she learned of the huge disparity between the United States and Mexico, between Tijuana and La Jolla, between the haves and the have-nots. So as these doctors fell over themselves to visit her, she sensed a tremendous opportunity. She asked the doctors what they were doing to give back, and then she asked them if they had ever seen the medical facilities a mere 25 miles away in Tijuana. Most of them said no. She then asked each doctor to add his or her name to a sign-up sheet outside her room, pledging to donate time and resources to help medical mobile clinics in Tijuana. The doctors, who were used to having the dominant frame, could not impress Mother Teresa with any of the usual trappings of their success. They could only do it by pledging their time and expertise to her cause. When it was time for her to leave the hospital, after 20 days at Scripps, Mother Teresa had imposed her frame on the richest, smartest, best educated, and highest social class in Southern California. And this was evidenced by the sheer number of doctors who had pledged their time to help out in Tijuana. And the doctors, without any noticeable effort, their frames had been shaken, broken, and disrupted. With the high-status surgeon power frame disrupted, Mother Teresa's frame took over. According to the Los Angeles Times, on January 16, 1992, Mother Teresa of Calcutta was released from the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation Hospital after securing a pledge from doctors and nurses to set up a volunteer network of mobile medical clinics to serve the poor in Tijuana. When asked whether she was going to take better care of herself in the future, she replied, "Yeah, sure." So reality is waiting to be framed. A hot cognition or a series of hot cognitions is a fast method for getting the target's croc brain to want you and your big idea. But this is not a sales technique. Stacking frames is not going to work, in my opinion, if you just view it as another type of sales tactic. Those old-fashioned sales techniques are about chasing the neocortex with features and benefits and rational explanations. Selling tempts you to do three things I dislike the most. Number one, to supplicate. Number two, to make rational appeals to the neocortex. And number three, to ask invasive questions. Hot cognitions, on the other hand, do not hit the target like a sales technique. Hot cognitions are primal. Whenever there's a rush of excitement, it's hard to get the neocortex to do any work at all. To protect us from potential physical or social threat, the croc brain hijacks brain function. No analysis gets done. As a result, it's much easier and natural to react to what's hot and vivid and moving right in front of us. Hot cognitions are primal. Hot cognitions are also unavoidable. You might be able to control the expression of emotion, but there's no way you can get out of the path of having it and experiencing it. So hot cognitions are unavoidable. Hot cognitions also tend to be instant and enduring. Do you like the movie you just watched? Do you like the new model of the Ford Mustang? Do you like eating snails? You never sat down to analyze any of these things. They're obviously hot cognitions. You got a sense of these things the moment you encountered them. So hot cognitions tend to be instant. Let's talk about the hot versus cold cognition. Maybe the best way to define hot versus cold cognition is to compare it to chocolate and spinach. You know the cold hard facts, right? Spinach is good for you. It has lots of nutrients. You should be eating more of it. But when offered a piece of chocolate instead, you go for it. The acid test of whether your pitch goes well will be, does the target want to buy your stuff, to be part of your team, or to invest in your idea? How much thinking about your presentation does the target need to do before he or she forms a preference about it? How fully and completely must an idea be presented and thought about? And how much rational analysis needs to be completed before the target decides good or bad? I argue here that as you approach the end of your pitch, you don't need to wait for an evaluation, or the target will wander off into a cold cognition process and think about you. Did we like him? Did we like his deal? Right? So instead, stack the four frames, trigger hot cognitions, and create the instant evaluation that should be wanting. If hot cognitions targeted at the croc brain are so powerful, why do most people make presentations in the cold cognition style, targeted at the neocortex? Here's why I think people go this way. Our faculties of reason tell us that the neocortex is way smarter than our croc brain. We think that if we create a message in our own smart neocortex, it should be sent to the target's neocortex, which will do a better job of understanding the pitch. It makes sense to think this way because the neocortex really is an insanely capable problem solver. It has awesome language and math and creative abilities. It's a Swiss Army knife of mental ability. By contrast, if the neocortex is like a Swiss Army knife, then the croc brain is like a rubber mallet, best for simple jobs only. It works only on a few emotions, and those are very limited in scope and range. The croc brain almost seems too simple to get our smart ideas. We think, who are we going to trust with this decision? The target's infinitely capable neocortex or the emotional and simplistic croc brain? Our intuition tells us to trust the neocortex. But that's not the right choice. Let's return to the essential idea from chapter one. No pitch or message is going to get to the logic center of the other person's brain without passing through the survival filters of the crocodile brain system first. And because of the way we've evolved, those filters make pitching anything extremely difficult. By this point, you know what I'm going to say next. Focus your energy on getting the target's croc brain to want your product. Because at best, no matter how much you try to sell to the neocortex, it can only like your idea. A hot cognition is the inner certainty of knowing something that comes through feeling it. A cold cognition is the certainty of knowing something is good or bad by having evaluated it. As I've said before, hot cognitions are extremely fast. Hot cognitions develop through the ancient brain structures, the brainstem and the midbrain. That's our croc brain. Cold cognitions are analytical and develop in the neocortex. Cold cognitions are calculated and take time to arrive at a solution. This is how the neocortex goes about its business. It aggregates information over time and solves problems slowly. You've heard the expression, just give me the cold, hard facts. This is what is meant by a cold cognition, the labor-intensive processing of facts through a decision matrix. You can trigger a hot cognition instantly, but cold cognition can take hours or days. Most presentations are set up to take the target down the path of a cold cognition. Then they try to justify the big idea with facts and information. Hot cognitions are different. They encode value. It's the anticipation of a large financial gain that is emotionally compelling to the target. Actually receiving that gain is not nearly as exciting. As one researcher noted, the human brain acquired its reward reinforcement system for food, drink, ornaments, and other items of cultural value long before money was discovered. The brain thinks of money as it does food, ornaments, and drugs, and records the utility that can be collected by using it only indirectly. There's no cash register or balance sheet up there. George Soros once wrote, "The philosophers of the Enlightenment put their faith in reason, and they expected reason to provide a full and accurate picture of reality. Reason was supposed to work like a searchlight, illuminating a reality that lay there passively, awaiting discovery." But as we've been discussing here, reality isn't waiting to be discovered. It's waiting to be framed. By stacking four frames quickly, one after the other, you can achieve the hot cognition in the target, helping the target to discover a wanting. And yet, once the frame stacking is complete, we've got the target's attention for about another 30 seconds, and it can still go all wrong. We have to find, in that brief time, a way to translate the target's desire into action. But how? What do you do now? Chapter 6, Eradicating Neediness. Over the years, I have faced a lot of rejection. And the disturbing thing about rejection is that you never really get used to it. It's natural and even unavoidable to feel disappointment when you get a no. We all do. What's certain is that none of us like to be rejected. We want to avoid it. In high-stakes situations, we're nearly always anxious about it. As business people, friends, neighbors, and citizens, we believe that when we need something from another person, there is a thin line of empathy that runs through all human hearts. We believe that we'll be treated well by others just because, but there isn't and we won't. We nearly always become anxious and needy. Showing signs of neediness is about the worst thing you can do to your pitch. It's incredibly bad for frame control. It erodes status. It freezes your hot cognitions. It topples your frame stacks. If you talk to investment bankers, the pros that make million-dollar decisions almost daily, they'll tell you validation-seeking behavior, which is neediness, is the number one deal killer. I'm going to talk now about four pitches, no room for mistakes. 12 years ago, I was trying to raise money for a technology company that I had also invested in. The company was quickly burning through cash. I needed to find a big-time investor, so each day I'd make up to 50 calls to leading venture capital firms. I talked to a lot of receptionists and secretaries, and I got a lot of voicemail action, but nobody was excited enough to return my call. My company had a great idea, but it was difficult to explain over the phone. I needed FaceTime to explain it, so I was desperate to simply land a meeting. I continued to be persistent, and the following week, I got a few people to pick up and try to pitch them by phone. That didn't go well. Bill Reichert at Garage Technology Ventures told me, "I have no idea why anyone would want to build it, use it, or invest in it." Ron Fisher at SoftBank Venture Capital said, "Do yourself a favor, son. Try a different idea." I reached Vinod Khosla at VC firm Kleiner Perkins, and he quickly transferred me to his analyst, an obvious dead end. I was getting nothing but rejections from the largest venture capital firms in North America. I questioned whether I should continue. It was a constant battle in my mind. Press on or give up. But I'd passed the point of no return. It sounds simple, but no greater truth exists in business today. Persistence pays. So I persisted. Eventually, I was able to get four big pitches lined up with top-tier venture capital firms. But setting a meeting is just step one in a two-step process. You have to impress and persuade or go home with nothing, which I was getting really good at, the going home with nothing part. This was a confidence killer for me. I knew I was good at pitching, but for some reason, my pitches were failing, and now I was in big trouble. I'm embarrassed to say it, but it's a matter of public record, and UCLA's Anderson School of Management has a case study on this deal. It's in their MBA program. I had less than $1,000 in my account, and my company was down to one final pitch. One last chance with a major VC firm before the cash ran out and our doors closed for good. I tried to develop a theory to explain what was going wrong, but I came up with nothing. I had a lot of self-doubt. What was I doing wrong? There must be something. Rather than make the same mistakes again and again and screw up my final pitch, I decided to regroup and reorganize myself. A bit humbled, I went back to my former employer to speak with the senior partner there, Peter. Peter was another master of the universe type, and I'd helped him put together a number of really big deals and made him a lot of money. If anyone would help me, it would be Peter. I shut his office door, and I sat down, unsure if he was going to help or just lecture me. After I thanked him for seeing me, he said, "Oren, I've watched your career very carefully, and while I see flashes of brilliance, you know I've also identified plenty of problems over the years." "Right," I said, bracing for the lecture that was to come. "You're just inconsistent," he went on. "Sometimes you're fantastic, and other times you let us down." We were always unsure which Oren we were going to get on what day. And I really wanted to defend myself, but I knew that nodding my head and staying quiet was the best approach for now. "Let's go back," he continued. "2 years ago, you seemed invincible. You had just helped us close Somatex, and that was the most profitable deal in our history." So how could I forget, right? Without me, that deal would have died. Guys got rich on that deal thanks to me. I remember it, I said. You were a few deals away from becoming a partner, Peter said to me. Becoming a partner, that's the most coveted position in any investment bank. And that had indeed been within my grasp. I'd also landed a sweet deal with Hershey's that made the firm over $1 million. And my work helped Peter's firm to close several other big deals. The competition could only watch in awe and envy as we put together a great run. You were strong and confident in acing deals that were really liked, Peter said, but his voice trailed off. I'm sure he was still disappointed and hurt that I had abruptly left the firm, seduced by the promise of the internet. I'm sorry, I told him, but I'm here because I'm in dire straits. I have one more chance or this whole thing that I'm working on is going to implode. He looked at me and nodded. For the next hour, I replayed the 3 failed venture capital meetings. When Peter asked me questions, eventually, over time, his eyebrows lifted. He smiled and he broke into a laugh. He stopped me mid-sentence. Warren, I know why you seem to have lost your edge. Why? I asked. He allowed the moment to build and finally said, because you're out there on your own and you know there's no safety net. Son, you're going to these meetings needy. Boom. I snapped to attention. Of course, classic validation-seeking behavior. Signals of desperation. No investor wants to work with a needy company run by an entrepreneur who is almost out of cash. Sure, the investor knows you need money, but giving a hint of neediness or a sign of desperation, plainly put, is like saying, I'm holding a bomb that could go off at any minute. Everyone will respond by going on the defensive. Their first reaction is run. Self-protection is an unconscious reaction that comes from the crocodile brain. This is the critical lesson of my failed pitches and the key to understanding why otherwise good deals can fail to impress the target. Neediness triggers fear and uncertainty, and that causes the target's croc brain to take over, but not in a good way. Its goal is to prevent further threat by effectively blocking out the higher-level brain, which likes to debate and consider and analyze. No time for that. Threat requires immediate attention. Neediness is a signal of threat. If you display neediness, it is perceived as just the kind of threat that the crocodile brain wants to avoid. Neediness results in avoidance. I knew that Peter was right, and I listened carefully as he gave me some advice on eliminating neediness. And although my situation was desperate, he told me, get some game. In other words, find some source of inner strength, confidence, and poise. Easy to say, hard to do. When pitches work well, we tend to believe that it was our great idea that impressed the target, or that our sublime explanation of the big idea was impressive and convincing. However, when pitches fail, we see it through a different lens. In such cases, we believe the problem lies with the target, not us. We believe the target somehow couldn't see the value of the big idea, or that he was the wrong target. But pitches can fail for reasons that are hidden from view. I thought back to my previous pitch, the 3rd of the 3 failures. A venture capital group in Silicon Valley was interested in my deal. During my call, the representative said, your executive summary was good, we like your idea, and under the right leadership, this could become a large company and eventually go public. We'd like you to come up on Tuesday to pitch the partnership. I had made plans to fly north and thought this was my big break. When we got there, though, the circumstances felt very familiar. I'd been in this position before. It was just another 1-hour meeting in an anonymous office building overlooking a freeway. The conference room looked virtually the same as any other one. I'd pitched in black leather chairs, a long conference table, a whiteboard at the end, and an easel in the corner. Thinking back on those days, if there's anything that reminds me of deal making, it's the whiff of dry erase markers. In 1999, no deal could be pitched properly without the extensive and highly abstract whiteboard diagrams. Now, when I was pitching, I spoke clearly and made my points elegantly. I maintained eye contact with the targets, as you're supposed to do, exuding calm confidence. My voice rose and fell with a dramatic tone as I drew a chart on their whiteboard, so artistic that if it had been preserved at that time, it would today be hanging in the Modern Art Hall of the Getty Museum. So before I knew it, 30 minutes had gone by. Although I felt that there was so much more to say, the targets were glancing at their watches. I knew it was time to wrap up, and with nearly perfect comedic timing, I delivered a joke, and laughter filled the room. I'd nailed the pitch. Now, I found myself in that awkward 2-minute period that every presenter must face after finishing his pitch. This is a dangerous beta trap and the easiest time to screw things up. Here's where small mistakes are amplified into deal killers. Slight missteps can erase all the good work you've done in the last 20 minutes. And it's unnerving because there's always an unspoken directive. You need something from the target. Usually, it's money. So, during the end of that third pitch, in front of some of the best venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, I became anxious and needy while I explained, "We need a lot of your money, and we need it fast." And at that point, I realized how high the stakes were. If these people said no, it would be my third rejection in a row, and the company would have almost no options left. I felt scared and anxious, and I said things like this. "So, do you think it's a good deal? Guys, so what do you think? We can sign a deal right away if you want us to." These things, the way I said them, were the purest form of validation seeking and the most lethal form of neediness. And that was the end of that opportunity. Just that fast. The target's excitement turned to fear and anxiety. And of course, I failed to get a term sheet or an investment offer. Now, why it's important to eradicate neediness. Plain and simple, neediness equals weakness. Broadcasting weakness by seeking validation is often a death sentence for a deal. This may sound harsh, but it's true. Neediness, displaying so-called validation-seeking behaviors, will affect all social interactions dramatically. It's almost redundant to criticize the concept of validation-seeking any further. Simply put, there's almost no way to get through the post-pitch time period if you are needy. Let's define validation seeking and neediness and talk about how to get through the 2-minute beta trap or any other point where you might be showing neediness. What causes neediness? You can tell when you're losing your audience because their growing discomfort is easy to read. They glance at their watches. They turn their bodies away from you. They cough nervously and they close their folder and stop leafing through materials. There are a lot of outward signs. When you notice audience members are uncomfortable, you feel yourself losing the deal. Your anxiety and insecurity start turning into fear, and you begin falling into acceptance-seeking behaviors. The experience of feeling disappointment creates problems that need to be considered carefully. When we feel even a touch of disappointment, our first reflexive reaction is to cure it by seeking validation, which, of course, broadcast neediness to the audience. Now our brain is subconsciously thinking, if I can just get them to agree to do a deal with me, everything will be okay. This is what our brain wants to relieve the stress and fear caused by rejection. If we are lucky and the target decides to give us the deal, all is well again. We instantly feel better, our anxiety fades, our heart rate returns to normal, and we feel in control. However, in the panic moment, caused by that flash of disappointment, we couldn't help but signal neediness to our target. Chances are good that he noticed it and will not respond by giving us what we want. What happens then? Further rejection poses the threat for an emotional catastrophe. In practice, here's how we fall into validation-seeking behaviors. Number one, when we want something that only the target can give us, a money, an order, a job, we set the stage for neediness. Number two, when we need cooperation from the target and can't get it, it's frustrating and it causes us anxiety. And audiences, at some point, always become uncooperative. Audience members turn their attention elsewhere, usually by texting, scanning an email, or taking phone calls. They allow interruptions by people coming in and out of the meeting room, or they cut us short before we've made our key points. Number three, neediness is created inside of us. When we firmly believe that the target can make us feel good by accepting our pitch and saying yes. When we set ourselves up to need the target to accept us, we have trapped ourselves. The more we want the target's desired behavior to occur, the more neediness we broadcast, and the less likely the target is to give us what we want. It's a downward spiral. And number four, finally, validation-seeking behaviors are triggered in us when the target seems uninterested in our pitch and he begins to withdraw or shifts his or her attention to something else. At that moment, we have a natural fear response, and the potential for an involuntary expression of neediness is high. Fear and anxiety are emotions that are both natural and reflexive, and they are very difficult to manage. Even the most common social rituals are loaded with situations that can trip us up. So you really need to pay attention to avoid outward signs of neediness, a reaction that surrenders your status and frame dominance. How to counteract your validation-seeking behaviors. One dramatic way to eradicate neediness involves going into every social interaction with a strong time frame that you're prepared to use at any moment. This frame communicates loudly and clearly that you are needed somewhere else. But this is just part of a broader, more comprehensive solution to eradicating neediness. Here's the basic formula. Number one, want nothing. Number two, focus on things you do really well. And number three, announce your intention to leave the social encounter. Executing these three steps will calm down the fear circuitry in your own brain. Your increased heart rate, perspiration, rapid breathing, and anxiety will subside slowly. Once under control, you'll impress others and make them actually come after you. Most important, the willingness to withdraw demonstrates a self-control, strength, and confidence that most targets will greatly admire. To better appreciate the importance of controlling validation-seeking behaviors, let's take a closer look at the way others have solved this problem. In the great film, The Tao of Steve, the lead character, Dex, also employs the withdrawal technique to maintain high status in social situations. The technique is part of a larger Taoist philosophy that Dex uses to guide his life. Dex is an elementary school teacher assistant who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with several roommates. He has a huge belly, he smokes pot, and his wild, unkempt look is the opposite of Madison Avenue's image of the American male. Looking at Dex from the outside, you'd assume he is not a social success. But surprisingly, the opposite is true. Dex is a practitioner of the Taoist philosophy, but with an ingenious twist, which I'll explain in a moment. Taoism is an Eastern philosophical and religious tradition that originated in China around 500 BC. It is based on the writings of the philosopher Lao Tzu. As in Buddhism, there's a heavy emphasis on connecting with the universe and controlling your desires. In the movie, Dex has developed his own derivative version of the Tao that draws its inspiration from popular culture. He calls it the Tao of Steve, named for three guys, Steves, who embody all the coolness and social poise that Dex is seeking. The three Steves are Steve McQueen, Steve Austin, and Steve McGarrett. Steve McQueen, the so-called King of Cool, rode an anti-hero persona to become the highest paid actor of his generation. His roles in movies such as The Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape, and Bullet won him a legion of female admirers and also cemented his reputation as a man's man. Steve McGarrett, Jack Lord, was the detective in charge of the elite crime unit in the popular 1960s show Hawaii Five-0. He was a no-nonsense, dedicated investigator who always stayed one step ahead of the bad guys. And Steve Austin, Lee Majors, was the bionic man in the 70s hit The $6 Million Man. Austin was a former astronaut who survived an experimental plane crash. He was rebuilt with bionic parts and became an operative for a covert government agency. All three Steves were noted for being cool without really trying. The actors helped convey this feeling by maintaining poise in pressure situations. They never got flustered, even with the bad guys closing in. Dex believed that the three Steves attracted admirers not because they had cool cars or bionic legs, but rather because they understood the three main rules of the Tao. Number one, eliminate your desires. It's not necessary to want things. Sometimes you have to let them come to you. Number two, be excellent in the presence of others. Show people one thing that you're very good at. And number three, withdraw. At the crucial moment, when people are expecting you to come after them, pull away. The Tao of Steve is the perfect philosophy to use when you finish your pitch. Use it to stifle the urge to seek approval from your audience. People want what they can't have. So when you finish your pitch, deny your audience. Start pulling away. In so doing, you banish insecurity and trigger a powerful prizing effect on your audience, and they will come to you. The final pitch. Going back to the story I was talking about earlier, now, finally, it was the day of my fourth and final pitch. 6 months ago, I had hundreds of thousands of dollars in my bank account. Now I had $468, enough for half of a payment on my Porsche. And that was if I didn't pay rent or eat. So nevertheless, in my head, I ran a constant audio loop. I don't need these people. They need me. I am the prize. I don't need these people. They need me. I am the prize. I stood in front of Enterprise Partners, the largest venture capital firm south of Silicon Valley. It was nearly 4 p.m. The people inside were ready to go home, but I needed to electrify them, light up the room, and most important, I needed to forget that this was do or die. If they sensed any desperation, my partner and I would go home busted. This was my last chance. I walked into a room of tired-looking investors. They'd been hearing pitches all day. None of them even bothered to say hello. That was unnerving. They asked me a series of hostile questions. They wondered aloud if the market was really big enough or if there was too much competition already. One of them actually laughed at our idea. And to make matters worse, the partner who brought us through the door, the ones who sponsored us, questioned whether we should even be an internet company instead, suggesting that we settle on making PC software, which was the equivalent of saying, I no longer support this deal. But none of that mattered. I delivered the knockdown, drag-out, bare-knuckled super pitch. Exactly 20 minutes of hardcore finance in a sexy internet wrapper. At the end, I continued with my plan to run the prize frame and to qualify them. I made 3 points. Here's exactly what I told the enterprise investors. Number one, this deal will be fully subscribed in the next 14 days. Number two, we don't need venture capital money, but we want a big name on our investor list that will strengthen our initial public offering. And number three, I think you guys are interesting, but are you really the right investor for us? We need to know more about you and the relationships and brand value your firm can bring to our deal. That was it. I was totally spent. At that moment, I couldn't muster enough mental power or energy to do anything but sit still and be silent. Now it was my turn to be the stone-faced gnome. I just sat there, with no trace of validation-seeking behavior, no neediness, waiting for them to react to me. To my surprise, they fully engaged with me and in minutes had committed to the deal. They wanted what I had. I'd redeemed myself with a great opening and finished the pitch with confidence and poise, and the whole thing came together perfectly. We sat in the room for another hour and discussed all the variables. We came up with a huge $14 million valuation, $6 million more than I expected. Yes, my bank account had dwindled to $468, but the next day, Enterprise officially agreed to invest. And a few days later, they wired $2.1 million into my account. I remember going to the ATM and getting a balance slip so that I could see the $2.1 million printed on it. 30 days later, Enterprise completed the financing with an additional $4 million. Despite the difficulties and the hard work, going after a deal is a thrill. Sure, I do it because I want the results, the loan, the job, the money, the deal, whatever, but that's not the only reason. I chase these things because the adventure excites me. All dealmakers know there's a king of the world moment when we close a deal, and that is never forgotten. It's the satisfaction of preparing for a high-stakes meeting, giving a mouth-watering pitch, and with a chest full of confidence, getting the deal. Over time, I would have had many fewer of these moments if I had not learned, never be needy. Chapter 7, Case Study, The Airport Deal. This is a story of a pitch so massive and so high stakes that in order to tell it properly, I need to tell you what happened in the months leading up to the day of the pitch. There's perhaps no other single deal I've ever been involved with that better demonstrates the ideas at the core of my method and why it works. If you find that this story borders on the cinematic at times, well, that's what it was like to be there. And that's what it's like when you're playing with hundreds of millions of dollars and there's so much at stake. Let's begin. I was 100 miles away from Los Angeles and in no hurry to return to the city. I had a good reason, too. Business was dead. The collapse of the U.S. economy had seized the credit markets, freezing deals for more than a year. After pitching nearly nonstop for more than 5 years, I found myself with nothing to pitch, literally nothing. This lack of action was frustrating because at the heart, I like the adrenaline rush that comes with playing this game. That's why I do it. I get the same adrenaline rush from action sports as I do in the boardroom where I've raised more than $400 million. Then it all went away. Poof, as the economy soured and the deal window shut. It was clear after a full year that it wasn't going to return to normal for a long time. That's why I decided to get away and get away from it all. The deal business had been very good to me, and I was in a position to do anything I wanted. I told friends, colleagues, everyone that I was done. I'm hanging up my guns, I said. And now I was due for some serious downtime in the middle of nowhere to figure out what I'd be doing next in life. A one-week vacation in the Anza Borrego Desert had turned into two, and I was enjoying all that the tiny town of Ocotillo Wells had to offer, which wasn't much. It was a Monday in December, a dry 78 degrees, and most of the weekend guests had now retreated from this outpost in Southern California, and on the east end of the Salton Sea, the solitude felt good. Most of my day was spent mountain biking and relaxing on the mesa. I snapped pictures of the sun as it settled behind the bluff. Life was good. And I was oblivious to the fact that someone was desperately trying to reach me. And this is about a monster deal. Across the mountain range that separates the high desert from the coast in Los Angeles, Sam Greenberg was that someone. He sat in his office, frustrated, wondering what it would take to get in touch with me. I had pretty much made myself unreachable. My phone had been switched off, my email autoresponder was on, and almost no one knew where I was staying. Greenberg had a deal on the table, though. A big deal, 10 figures, $1 billion. He wanted me to be his point man, just like the way things were before the economy collapsed. Greenberg was a man of action. He kept a private jet at Palomar Airport, not as a luxury item, but as a tool to get to the deals faster than the next guy. He would find me, get the plane in the air, and get me back to work. At least, that was his plan. And his plan served his purpose. An acquaintance finally spilled my hotel information, and Greenberg left a short message on the hotel answering machine. "Hey, I've got a monster deal," he said in a loud voice. "Call me today, as soon as possible." 3 hours later, I entered my hotel room and I saw the red light flashing. So much for privacy. Who needs to reach me that badly? Only a handful of people knew how to get in touch. I listened to Greenberg's message, alternately ignoring it and then wondering about it. No! After 10 years of nonstop dealmaking, I'd sworn off deals. I'd sworn off the industry in total. No. I was resolute, but I owed Greenberg enough to call him back and tell him as much. When he answered the phone, my first word was, "No." "I haven't even told you about the deal," Greenberg said. Greenberg had a natural gift of persuasion and typically got what he wanted, but this time, I was sure I wanted no part of it. "My answer is still no," I said. "Just listen to me for 1 minute," Greenberg demanded. "It's not going to matter," I said. "I've seen about every deal out there. It's a wasteland." Greenberg told me about a deal right in our backyard, Davis Field, a regional airport on the outskirts of Los Angeles, and it was being rechristened as a large private fixed base operator, FBO, as a relief valve for the overflowing Los Angeles airspace, and would need a whopping $1 billion raised to finance the deal. "You can't turn this one down," Greenberg bellowed. "This is not some shopping center. This is a friggin' airport." "It sounds great, but I can't do it," I said. "I'm out of the game." After three or four expletives, Greenberg tried another approach. "That's fine. I got someone lined up anyway. Someone else will do it." And his voice trailed off. After a long pause, I took the bait. "Who do you have?" He said, "Barnes." "Oh, come on, please." "He can pull it off," Greenberg said. "And on your end, I guess we'll just chalk it up to a missed opportunity. You're going to kick yourself." Greenberg indeed had another guy lined up, but everyone knew that Paul Barnes was not exactly the best. Greenberg decided to stop his pursuit for now. "Have fun sticking your head in the sand while we're doing a monster deal," he added in closing. Then he hung up, not even waiting for my response. I laughed and thought about the call. Over the years, I'd become hardwired to analyze every pitch to find out what worked and what didn't. Greenberg's pitch meant there was just one deal in a dead market, and that was no reason to become unretired. I called the front desk and asked the clerk to hold all calls. 2 weeks went by, and sure enough, Paul Barnes did not perform as expected. Sure, he was confident and he had a great analytical mind, but he couldn't think on his feet. If circumstances changed or things got off plan, he spooked easily. When Greenberg suddenly asked him to fly to Chicago on a red eye for a meeting, Barnes begged off. "Oh, I need a few days to prepare," he said. "One of the things my business associates know about me is this. I would go anywhere, anytime, to make a deal happen. If a flight was canceled, I'd drive. No cars, I'll take the bus. And after all of these years, Greenberg trusted me. He wouldn't think twice about making a strategy change based on my recommendations. So Greenberg started getting a little worried. He had 2 months to prepare the pitch for the airport selection committee.